Dr. Maurer, fellow Federationists, and friends. During the past few months, we have seen the reprise of a phrase that was the watchword that rang out so loud and strong after 9/11. Every time today I hear, as I heard then, people say, "We've got to get back to normal," I think about the fact that in reality, we can't, because normal will never be the same again. Rather than trying to get back to normal, we need to find a new normal, a normal that incorporates that which happened to us and that which will help us move forward. Sometimes a new normal becomes our way of life gradually. We got a new normal in our lives when we started flying in airplanes and transportation became so easy for such long distances. A new normal began to emerge when radio was developed. And yes, a new normal emerged when television came on the scene, the new medium. Although, as Fred Allen says, I understand why it's called the new medium, because everything they do in television is only medium. Normal sometimes is thrust upon us, as happened with 9/11. We in the National Federation of the Blind are involved in creating a new normal every day. Our opportunities to do that are challenged on a regular basis, however, and I refer specifically to one instance that recently occurred when Dr. Richard Besser, ABC medical correspondent, reported on what could be a major breakthrough in stem cell research on June 23rd of this year. Dr. Besser reported about stem cells and how one's own stem cells out of the eye could be used to regenerate corneas. But he started his report this way: "Imagine all the beauty of life gone in an instant. Suddenly blinded by a terrible accident, you can only see light and dark. But now, through a seismic breakthrough using stem cells from one's own eye, promises new sight to those blinded by burns." The report was great. The report was fine. It is great to see stem cell research moving forward, especially using one's own stem cells to regenerate organs or parts of one's own body. But look at how he started his report. He did it on the backs of and at the expense of blind people by saying, "Imagine all the beauty of life, all the beauty of life gone in an instant." Dr. Besser made it very clear that blind people, in his estimation, cannot see the beauty of life. Namely, he believes that you can only experience the beauty of light, of life by sight. In reality, we know you experience the beauty of life by vision, which does not need sight. Dr. Besser's report had its shock value. But Dr. Besser, like many, as we have heard today, in the ophthalmological and medical profession, need to learn a new normal. Oh, it's normal in many people's minds that blind people can't do a lick of work or do anything at all, but that's their perception. And I suppose from their idea of things, that makes it normal. But the reality is, we know different. We who are blind need to show Dr. Besser and others that the beauty of life goes far beyond sight. We need to show him that we do experience the beauty of life. Sitting in my backyard, I hear the hawks flying overhead, trying to find the baby ducks, and we save the baby ducks by shooing the hawks away. But we can hear them. We can experience them. We see the beauty of life in so many ways. The beauty of life is here in this room, in this organization. An organization founded 70 years ago by a man who was born on July 6th. Happy birthday, Dr. Tenbrook. But we also do see the horrors of life. We also, as those who have sight, although sometimes not vision, see the horrors of life. We see it every time we experience discrimination. We see it every time blind parents are told they can't keep their children and have to fight to get them back. We see it every time a blind person is denied access to flying on an airplane or going in a building or living our lives. We also see the horrors of life because we have grown as people so much that we are out in the world like everyone else. Certainly for me, the greatest horror of life I could ever experience was being in the World Trade Center on 9/11. And I want to tell you the story. Because out of the horror, out of all that happened, also is a beautiful story, a story of teamwork, a story of people helping each other, and a story of growth, which makes what happened in the World Trade Center so important and such a pivotal point for positive gain in all of our lives. Every time I think of what happened on 9/11, I'm reminded of the words of Mahatma Gandhi, who once said, "Interdependence ought to be and is as much the ideal of man as his self-sufficiency." Because on 9/11, everyone helped everyone else. For me, it started at 1 in the morning when we started experiencing a thunderstorm. And my guide dog at the time, Roselle, does not like thunderstorms. Today, she's a little better about them, but we don't have many in California. Back then, she was very fearful. And we had a thunderstorm early in the morning, so we had to go down to my basement, where we usually go, turn on the stereo, turn on the computer, do some work, and try to mask the noise for her. She goes and hides under my desk. Especially though, that morning it was a little bit frustrating because I had to prepare and was ready to go in to do some special work in our office. I worked at the time for Quantum Corporation and was the regional sales manager for the Mid-Atlantic region for Quantum. We were going to be conducting some special training sessions that day for some of our reseller partners. I was going to get up earlier than usual to be in the office before everyone arrived and still had to do it even though I had to be up for an hour and a half in the middle of the night. I went to the office. The best laid plans always go awry in one way or another, so I planned to take an early train and the trains broke down, so I didn't get there early after all. I arrived just as a gentleman from the Port Authority cafeteria complex was bringing food that we were going to serve that day. As I tell people, some of the best ham and cheese croissants I've ever had. Missed them terribly. We went in, he set up, I went to my office. Soon, David Frank, a colleague from our California office who was in that day, also arrived with some of our early guests. David was there because he had account responsibility for some of the people who were in that day. We set up the laptop to do the PowerPoint presentation. I was going to be doing that. It's great when a blind person does a PowerPoint presentation. Everybody thinks you can't do it. What's really fun is doing it and never turning around to look at the screen, because I know what's on the slides. So all I have to do is point back. I was told on many occasions, you know, we didn't dare fall asleep when you were presenting because you kept looking out at us. We forgot you're blind and we just didn't dare fall asleep because we thought you'd notice. My response, of course, was, I would have noticed. Besides, my guide dog, Roselle, takes notes and we would know who you are. Nevertheless, David was there. Some early arrivals were there. We were all set up, waiting for the rest of the guests to arrive. At 8:45 in the morning, David and I were in my office doing some final preparations for Port Authority security, preparing a list of all the people who would be in that day, when suddenly we heard a muffled explosion, the building shuddered, and then it began to tip. The whole building began to move in one direction, not shaking back and forth like we in California know earthquakes do. If any of you haven't experienced one, maybe we can set it up somewhere. We have a Jesuit priest here. He ought to be able to help with that. Maybe if we raised enough funds, he could do it. But the building began to move in one direction. As we learned later, that was as it should be, because the building actually had expansion joints that made it operate like a very large spring. For those of us in the physics world, we understand that. So the building kept tipping and tipping and tipping. And David and I said, what's going on? There were no noises coming from our conference room. David and I speculated. I, having grown up in California and used to earthquakes, moved to the doorway, recognizing that building moves, go to door, doesn't matter if it's an earthquake. And hey, we were only 78 floors above the street, but hey, you move to the door anyway, it's habit. We moved to the door. David stayed holding on to my desk. He's from New York. He didn't know earthquakes. Roselle was asleep under my desk. And David and I said, are we going to fall to the street? The building kept tipping. We moved about 20 feet. David and I said goodbye to each other because we thought we were going to fall 78 floors to the street below. About that time, the building stopped. And it began moving back the other way. It moved, hope against hope that we weren't going to fall, and suddenly the building was straight up again, and I went back into my office meeting Roselle coming out from under my desk. I took her leash, I told her to heel, which meant to get on my left side and sit, which she did, and about that time the building dropped straight down about 6 feet. That also is as it should be, although we didn't know it at the time. That was because the expansion joints were contracting. The building worked perfectly. As soon as the building dropped, David released his hold on my desk, turned around, looked out the window, and started shouting, oh my God, there's fire and smoke above us, and there are millions of pieces of burning paper falling outside the window. We got to get out of here right now. And I could hear the paper falling outside the window. Wasn't smelling smoke, but I certainly believed what David was saying. Buildings don't do what ours just did without something being wrong. And he kept saying, we got to get out of here. And I said, slow down, David, because you see, I had taken the Port Authority classes that were available on emergency evacuation. I had also participated in fire drills, and I also had, thanks to the Port Authority, a copy of the fire safety and procedures manuals in Braille. Somewhere along the line after receiving that manual, I took it home. And so it is still on my bookshelf in a prized place today. David kept saying, we got to get out of here. And I kept saying, slow down, David. We will, but we're going to evacuate in an orderly way. And he said, no, you don't understand. We got to get out of here right now. And I kept saying, slow down. Our guests began to scream. They started moving toward our exits. And David kept saying, we got to get out of here. There are millions of pieces of burning paper falling outside the window. And there's smoke and there's fire. We can't stay here. You get the picture? The sighted guy is seeing all this horrific stuff, and the blind guy is saying, slow down. But I knew something that David didn't. I was observing something that David was not. It goes back to using all the skills that we have, all the wisdom that each of us have gotten from the National Federation of the Blind and our own life experiences. I was observing a dog sitting next to me who was wagging her tail and yawning and not indicating in any way that she felt nervous. And although our situation could have changed in a moment, at that instantaneous point in time, I knew that we could evacuate safely according to procedure. I finally got David to focus and said, "David, get our guests to the stairs and start them down, and then we'll leave." He did. He got to the stairs. He took them to the stairs and started them on their way down while I called my wife Karen to let her know that we were going to be evacuating because there had been an explosion or something, and that I would call her as soon as I could. I should explain that we both are disabled. We both have disabilities. Karen's in a wheelchair. It works out great. She reads. I push. I always wanted to be a pusher, you know. California. So David came back. We took one sweep through the office. We tried to power down some equipment. We knew we weren't going to be back for days, and so we wanted to save power. We had no idea how bad it really was, of course. We left. We went to the off to the stairs, and by 8:50, we started down. Almost immediately, I began smelling an odor. The odor that I smelled was familiar, but I couldn't place it. People around me couldn't figure it out. And suddenly I realized this that we're smelling are the fumes from burning jet fuel. It's kerosene, propane. And I observed that to people and they said, "Yeah, you're right, that's what it is." And so we assumed that an airplane, because we thought it was burning jet fuel, we thought an airplane had hit our building, but we didn't know why. But we all went down the stairs, we continued down, and after a few floors, somebody shouted from above us, "Burn victim coming through, move to the side of the stairwell so that they can get by." And a group of people then passed us, as David described it, with a woman surrounded by a number of people, and the woman was very badly burned on her upper body. There were just burns all over her. But she was ambulatory and able to walk. David said she looks in shock, but she was moving down the stairs. After she passed us, we started down again, and a few floors later, we heard it again. "Burn victim coming through, move to the side." We did. The same scenario again. A group surrounding someone very badly burned passed us on the stairs. Almost as soon as that second party had gone, a woman near us on the stairs stopped, and she said, "I can't breathe, I can't go on, we're not going to make it out of here." All of us around her stopped, surrounded her, and had a group hug and said, "Look, we're in this together. Of course you can go. We'll help you. We're with you. Don't worry." And we kept going down the stairs, and so did she. Soon after that, however, my friend David said, "Mike, we're going to die. We're not going to make it out of here." And I'm going, "Oh, gee." I said, "Stop it, David. If Roselle and I can go down these stairs, so can you." And he told me later that snapping at him like that brought him out of his funk. And what he then did was something I think is still truly remarkable today. He left me and walked down a flight of stairs below us and then started shouting up to me everything that he saw. He shouted up what floor he was on and if he saw anything on the stairs, and he stayed a floor below where I was. But it wasn't I think, who needed it most. It was all the other people around us. David became a scout, a beacon for so many people on the stairs as he shouted, "I'm at floor 48, 47, everything's okay, 46, 45, floor 44, we're at the Port Authority cafeteria entrance, 43, and he continued down. Up above, I knew that the fear was palpable. You could cut it with a knife, as they say. I knew most of all that I had to keep Roselle focused. So I continued to praise her. "Good girl, you're doing great. Keep going down the stairs. Good girl, hop up. Just keep focusing, good girl." I was told later that that certainly also helped a bunch of people, but it really helped me because it kept me focusing on her rather than what was going on around us. Oh, I kept an ear out for any noises from above that might say the building was going to fall on my head. A lot of good it would do. But focusing on her and speaking confidently helped her focus. And her guiding down the stairs and not looking back at me and not acting fearful in turn told me that she was okay and that I could be okay. We all helped each other going down the stairs. It was interdependence. It was teamwork. But you know, I did have a fear going down the stairs. Now, I grew up thinking always that blindness really wasn't the handicap, that the real handicap of blindness consists of the attitudes, the poor attitudes and misconceptions that people have about blindness, as well as the poor attitudes and misconceptions that we have about ourselves. But nevertheless, I knew that there were certain situations that I could certainly function better than the average sighted guy, and that certainly was, on 9/11, a possibility that I might face. Namely, I was worried that although we had power and lighting, that suddenly the lights would go out and I'd be on the stairs with thousands of functionally blind people who couldn't find their way out of a paper bag. And so I said to people, now I don't want anyone to worry. If the lights go out, Roselle and I are here and we're offering a half price special to get you out today only. Gotta sell too, you know. We continued down the stairs. We all helped each other, sometimes with humor, sometimes with just speculations. We heard rumors that two planes had collided and one crashed into the towers, that a plane went out of control. We heard all sorts of things. We also just talked among ourselves. I remember at one point, just to lighten the mood, because it sounded like it was getting pretty somber, I said, hey, now, on the first day they allow us back, let's all meet on the 78th floor at 8:45 in the morning and walk down the stairs together. What a great way to lose weight, huh? I was not dumb enough to suggest that we start at the bottom and work up. I know about gravity. 33, 32, floor 31, David spoke. 30, hey, everybody, firemen are coming up the stairs. Move to the side, let the firemen by. I went on down to where David was, and I asked him what he saw, and he said, I see firemen coming up the stairs. They're all dressed in their heavy protective clothing, and they're carrying all their equipment on their backs, oxygen cylinders, fire axes, shovels, all the things that they need to fight the fire. And then finally the first one got to us, and he stopped. Good New Yorker that he was. He goes, hey, buddy, you okay? And I said, yes, I'm fine. Don't worry. We're good. Well, we're going to send somebody down the stairs with you to make sure you get out. And I said, don't worry about it. We're okay. He said, yeah, maybe. That's okay. But we're going to send somebody with you. And I said, look, don't worry about it. You know, it wasn't the time to give him a lecture about blindness isn't the handicap, you know. And he said again, we're going to send somebody with you. But I was worried. I had this fear, actually, because I was concerned that if he sent somebody with me that was really needed up above and something happened and they were lost, they were minus one person that could have made the difference, I didn't want to be responsible for that. So again, I said, look, I got my guide dog. We've come down from the 78th floor without any help. We're really okay. Don't worry about us. Yeah, that's nice. What a nice dog. He starts petting Roselle. Wasn't the time to give him a lecture about don't pet the working guide dog in harness. I said, look, we really are okay. And he said, yeah, we're going to send somebody with you. And I finally used the last gun just because. I said, look, I've got a friend here, David. David can see we're really okay. He turned to David. You're with him? David said, yeah, we're good. Don't worry. Okay. He gave Roselle one more pat. Roselle gave him some kisses. Probably the last unconditional love he ever got in his life. And he went on up the stairs. The firemen truly were heroes. The people we lost, the firemen we lost, all the people. I think everyone acted heroically on 9/11 in so many ways, but certainly the people we lost are heroes, and we have to recognize that. I never ask people to mourn their passing. I've spoken to many firemen since. And I'm going to do what I've done with them and ask you not to have a moment of silence to mourn their passing, but would you help me celebrate the lives of the people we lost by giving them a round of applause? And so while firemen continued to pass us going up the stairs and our effectively wide stairwell was now cut in half, we continued down the stairs. David reassumed his scouting position, 28, 27, and we continued down the stairs. Slower than before, more bodies on the stairs, but we kept going. It kept getting warmer because of all the humanity. Water bottles were passed up so that each of us could have a drink. We shared, Roselle, David, and I, a bottle of water, and we kept going. David again reassumed the scouting position. Finally, David got to the first floor. We were on the second floor, and he said, "Hey, everybody, hey, Mike, the water sprinklers are on in the stairwell at the bottom. You're going to have to run through the water to get out into the lobby," and then he was gone. We got to the bottom. There was this torrential downpour. I took Roselle's harness and said forward and then said hop up, which is a command to speed up. And we burst through this torrential downpour that was acting as a curtain to keep fire out of the stairs or in the stairs and out of the lobby if it came down the stairwell, and burst out into the lobby of Tower 1, ankle deep in water. Every step you took, you trudged through this water and stepped on and broke ceiling tiles that had fallen and pieces of marble that were cracked and broken underfoot. People were in the lobby shouting, "Go this way, go this way," never letting anyone go outside, but rather rushing everybody through the lobby, through the central doors, into the arcade that separated all of the towers. The arcade, which was a typical shopping mall that had all the usual things that you'd find in a fairly small but very busy shopping mall. A Hallmark greeting card store. A Radio Shack, a 24-hour passport photo. And there were the important places, the ones that really mattered. Godiva Chocolate, the deli. All places that you'd find in a mall, typically full of thousands of people at about 9:35 in the morning, but now totally quiet. You could hear your footfalls as you ran through the lobby, through the tower arcades, finally up an escalator, and at 9:45 in the morning, we burst into sunlight for the first time since leaving our offices. As we got outside, we were told to leave the complex, but before we did, David looked around and he said, "Mike, I think I see fire in Tower 2. And I said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "There's fire up there." We had no idea. We heard nothing. No one told us anything. We had no clue as to what had happened. But as we were told, we left the complex, circled back around to get onto Broadway, and started traveling north toward Midtown Manhattan, crossing several streets and then finally reaching Fulton Street, where we stopped. So we were north. We would have been on the southwest corner when we stopped, which put Tower 2 diagonally right across the street from us, less than 100 yards away. David wanted to take pictures of what he could see. I tried to call my wife Karen and wasn't able to reach her. David was just putting his camera away, and I had just put my phone away after getting another circuits or busy message when a police officer near us yelled, "Get out of here, it's coming down now!" And we heard this rumble that quickly turned into this deafening roar, this incredible cacophony of sound that I can only describe as kind of a combination of a freight train and a waterfall all together. It was Tower 2 collapsing less than 100 yards diagonally across the street from us. Keep in mind, it was 400 yards tall, less than 100 yards away. Everyone turned and ran for their lives. No one was helping anyone. David was long gone. I bodily turned Roselle around and started going back the way I came, going from Fulton Street back to the previous street. And I remember as I ran thinking, "God, I can't believe that you let us out of a building just to have it fall on us." And I will tell you something that I don't tell many people, but because of some of the presentations today, I will. I heard in my mind, as clearly as you hear me, a voice that said, "Don't worry about the things that you can't control. Focus on running with Roselle, and the rest will take care of itself." I had that conviction of peace that if we did as instructed, we'd be okay. So we ran. We got to the next street, turned right to try to put a building between us and Tower 2 collapsing, as if it would really make a difference. I ran a little bit and suddenly caught up to David, who realized that he had run and we were separated and he had turned around and was going to come back. I caught up with him and he apologized and said, "I'm sorry, Mike, I left you." I said, "David, don't worry, the building's coming down. Let's keep going." So we ran. Almost immediately, we were engulfed in the dust cloud that were the fine particles of Tower 2's breakup. The dirt and debris that, as David described, were so thick that you could only see about 6 inches in front of your nose. I can tell you it was so thick that you could feel it going down your throat with every breath you took. We were drowning in it, and we knew that we had to get out of that. So we began looking for an entrance to the building that was right on our right-hand side. Rocks and debris were falling around us. We were partially protected by an overhang, but still I was hit in the ear and in the head a couple times with some small rocks. We kept running, and I kept telling Roselle, "Right, right." David was looking. I was listening for an opening. Suddenly I heard an opening, and Roselle obviously saw it because she turned right, took one step, and stopped dead. Roselle had been working appropriately. Roselle had been doing everything that she should, so I knew that if she stopped, there had to be a reason. So reaching out a foot, I discovered that we were at the top of a flight of stairs. She did exactly what she was supposed to do. We walked down the stairs and found ourselves in a lobby, the lobby small arcade to the Fulton Street subway station. And as I reached the bottom of the stairs, I heard a woman crying and saying, "Help, I can't see, my eyes are filled with dirt, and I don't want to fall into the subway." I happened to be close to her when I got down the stairs. I reached out and took her arm and said, "Don't worry, I happen to be blind, but I've got a guide dog, Roselle. She's doing well. She'll make sure that neither of us fall down the stairs. You're okay." How quickly teamwork reasserted itself, helping others, working together. Just after I said that to this woman, I introduced myself. She said her name was Carol. I introduced myself. And then a guy from the subway system, as he introduced himself, came up the stairs. He said, "My name's Lou. I work for the subway. Come with me." There were about 8 or 9 of us there. We followed him down the stairs into the subway complex. He took us to an employee locker room where there were benches and there was a water fountain and a fan, and Lou told us we could all stay there. We stayed for about 15 minutes until a police officer found us and said, "You need to leave now. The air is clear up above." Without saying anything else, we followed him. He brooked no response at all. He was just busy doing what he needed to do. We followed him like sheep up the stairs, through the arcade, and then up the final set of stairs, emerging into sunlight again, and the air was a little better than it was when we went down. David looked around and said, "Oh my God, Mike, there's no Tower 2 anymore." I said, "David, what do you see?" And he said, "All I see are pillars of smoke, hundreds of feet tall, but there's no Tower 2. And I said, "Are you sure?" And he said, "Yeah." We stood there in shock for a moment and then just turned and walked west on Fulton Street. We walked for about 10 minutes and then decided to circle back around to try to get up to a way to get to Midtown Manhattan. And as we started again, suddenly we heard that freight train waterfall sound again. We knew it was Tower 1 collapsing. We thought we were far enough away that we wouldn't be hurt and hit by debris, but David did see another dust cloud coming, so we ran to get out of its path, or the path of the main part of the cloud, covered our faces, closed our eyes, and waited for it to subside. When it did, we opened our eyes and David looked around. I remember again what he said, "Oh my God, there's no World Trade Center anymore." I asked him again what he saw, and he said, "All I see are fingers of fire and pillars of smoke, hundreds of feet tall. The World Trade Center is gone." We just stood there in silence for a couple of minutes, and then I tried to call my wife Karen on the phone, and this time got through. And after tears on both ends of the line, she's the one who told us how two aircraft had deliberately been crashed into the towers, one into the Pentagon, and a fourth was still missing over Pennsylvania. We had been attacked. We started making our way toward Midtown Manhattan. We got to Chinatown and stopped at a little Vietnamese restaurant there for a while to rest. While there, suddenly we heard aircraft in the skies, this loud aircraft sound. Everyone had this sudden intake of breath. Many ran outside and suddenly burst into applause as we saw that it was our guys controlling the skies again. We finally made our way to Midtown Manhattan, and later that day I was able to catch a train to New Jersey, to Newark, and then later to Westfield. Meanwhile, a close friend of our family's, who Karen had known since high school in California, Tom Painter, had come to be with her, and when he arrived, he didn't even know if I was alive or dead. But later that day, he drove Karen to the train station, picked me up. I heard the van arrive as we arrived. I went down the stairs, across the sidewalk, up the ramp into our van, and got to hug Karen for the first time. And as we compared notes later, we both were thinking the same thing. What else did they have planned that might cause us never to see each other again? But we were able to. We went home, and with Tom Painter, dogs, and all of us, we started trying to make sense of what happened. Our story became visible in the media. I've had a number of opportunities to appear on television shows like Larry King Live several times, and The Morning Show, Regis and Kelly Live, and other shows to tell the story. The story of horror, but the story of beauty and the story of teamwork. The story that says that we can survive disaster, we can survive change, and that even the worst kind of change, the change that appears the most horrific, might in fact indeed be a way to change for good, a positive change. But we need to work together to make change happen, usually. We need to act as a team. And so I tell the 9/11 story to help people understand what happened and how they might be able to survive change, and to help them think about preparing for the change that you don't expect, and to make the changes that you do expect, or to learn to expect change and make it happen. In other words, to find a new normal. Dr. Besser, the new normal really is here. You may not know it, you may not see it, but close your eyes and use your vision, and you'll learn a whole lot more than you know now. I continue to tell the story. And something that we've dreamed about for a while is about to happen, and I'm going to announce it here first, and that is that with the help of a friend that I have made and with some guidance, we're finally going to write a book about 9/11, and we will have it at next year's convention. It will be the... It isn't just my story, however, and it isn't just a 9/11 story. It's your story. It's our story. It's the story of what it is like to be blind and how there is a new normal. My co-author, Susie Flory, took time from her vacation to be here at this convention and is sitting in the California delegation to learn. Chip McGregor is one of the top literary agents in the country, and he has taken this project on and is working on final negotiations and efforts with some publishers. And so this book will happen. You can help, however. On my website, www.michaelhingson.com, is a place where you can sign up to receive notifications about the book. The more people who go to the website and enter their names, and you'll get nothing, you'll get no ongoing advertisements and so on, we'll just keep you posted. But if people indicate their interest in the book, that will show publishers how important this is. So I invite you to go to, again, www.michaelhingson.com, and put in your name and email address. Again, it's our story. It's the story of teamwork. It's the story of the new normal. It's the story that tells us that we can and do live in a better world because of all that we have done. 9/11 happened. As horrific as it was, there were beautiful parts. You've heard some of them. I invite you to go forward from here and help us create a new normal. Go totally globally mobile, by the way. Visit us in the exhibit hall. But help us develop a new normal and help the good guys win. Thank you very much.